Hello, and welcome back to Talking Talmud. I'm one of your hosts here, Dana Azban, here with my friend and Chavruta, Ann Gordon. Our daf today, Masechet Eruvin, daf Samechet, 68. So as I just said yesterday, I'm going to really start right at the top of our daf, which is in the middle of a story that we sort of ended in the middle of yesterday. And we're in this discussion of a case where some warm water that was needed for a baby who was going to have their Brit Milah on Shabbat spilled. And Rabba needed to figure out a way of how to get this water to this baby. And lo and behold, it turned out that he actually had not participated in any type of Eruv for Shabbat so that the warm water could actually be carried from his house. One of the things that we brought up yesterday is a distinction was made from Rav Yosef when he was discussing this situation with Abaye, that when it comes to rabbinic law, that you sort of can do and then object later. The top of the daf tries to make a distinction between a rabbinic decree that involves an action versus a rabbinic decree that does not involve an action. But I really just wanted to continue on with the story a little bit farther down at the top of the daf. Amar le Rabba bar Rav Hanan Labai. So Rabba bar Rav Hanan, when he heard about this story, he says the following to Abaye, which was the question that we sort of raised yesterday. Muvoad de Ace Bay Tre Gavre Ravrave Karabanan La Lahabebe La Arab Vila Shituf. So, you know, Rabba Bar Rav Hanan says to Abaye really the obvious question here, right? That we know that Rabba said, carry it from my house, and Abaye had to come and sort of remind him, oh, by the way, Rabba, you actually hadn't, you know, participated in an Arab or in a Shituf. So you actually can't carry from your house and the Chatzar in any way. And so he basically says, so an alleyway that has such two great people, right? Here you have Rabba and Abaye that live there, that there was no way that there was an Erev or the Shituf, that this was not made before Shabbat. Amar le, so Abaye answers him, Ma naved, mar la orche, lav orche, ana, tridna begirse, inhu lo mishkechi. Right? So what does he say? He says to him, what should we do? He says, for Rabba, it's not his manner, right? He doesn't go and get an Erev from all the residents of the alleyway, right? Maybe the implication is here, he's such a big rabbi, right? That this isn't something that he would do. Maybe his household should do it on his behalf. And that would make sense, right? Because it was almost like he didn't know, he was unaware that he had not, you know, participated in any sort of Erev. And Abaye for himself, right? He says what? He says, I'm busy with my studies, right? I'm busy. And like, this is just not something that I needed to do. And they, meaning the other residents of the alleyway, they didn't bother to attend to this matter. So it's kind of interesting. He's sort of saying, no, we have excuses for why we didn't get around to do this, even though it seems to be that the rabbinic standard is that everybody participated in some Eruv or Shituv so that they would be able to carry on Shabbat. The akni luhu pizza vesala kevend I baule mine velo efshar litva ninhu batel shituv. And if I were to transfer, so now we're going to get back to, you know, how you actually make the Erev himself. So Abaye now tells us something else very interesting about himself, that if he were to give, you know, transfer bread in his basket, right, to the other residents so that they could do the shituv or they could do this Erev, right, they would want to actually take it from him, the bread, and it would be impossible for him. That's what he says. He wouldn't be able to do it. He wouldn't be able to give it to them. And therefore, what? He would not write batel shituv, right? The shituv would be not valid because he wouldn't be able to actually give the bread. Now, why would Abaye not be able to actually give over this bread? Because he actually was very poor and he actually needed the bread. Remember, the idea of when you made this Erev or you made this shituv is that everybody sort of contributed some type of food, and then it was left in one common place or in one person's chatzar or in one person's house, right? But you physically had to give over something that, you know, you may not, may have really relied on to actually eat. Now, this is interesting to me because the Erev could have been eaten over on Shabbat, but Abaye seems to be saying he couldn't even afford to spare, to spare this bread. So he wants to give a proof for this to Tanya. So he says in a brisa, it says, Echam ibnei mavoi should be keshiyayim v'shemen, v'lo natnulo batel hashituf, right? If one of the residents of the alleyway is requested of him wine or oil, right, so they can make the shituf, and they don't give it to him, right, then actually there's no shita, because if he can't actually give it, you know, give the swine or oil, then it really shows that it's like an invalid. It's not like he really participated in the cooperative of making this Erev. So Rav Bar Rachana asks him, asks him the following, right? Maybe this could have been the solution. Right? So he says to him, okay, so why doesn't the master say that you'll give a quarter lug of vinegar that's in one of your barrels? In other words, a bai could, you know, definitely would have been able to afford to give this small amount of vinegar, right? We know that you can give any type of food. It's not limited what type of food you give. Traditionally, it seemed to have been from the discussion, maybe they gave bread, but you could really give any food. So let him give something that was in storage, right? And so what is a bai answer to that, right? Tanya, so he quotes a braisa, ein mishtatzefim ba'otzer, right? When you make this shitu, if you don't use food that's in a storeroom, right? Because it's not really clear what portion of it would be being used and how it was being set aside. So this would be sort of the same thing. So the idea that you have vinegar in a barrel somewhere and you're basically saying to them, okay, a quarter of a lug of the vinegar that's in that barrel, I'm committing it to this shituf or to this eruv, right? That's not really giving it over, right? It has to be food I think is readily accessible and that you can give over immediately to the cooperative. Now, this is interesting to me also, this brisa, because when we talked about establishing a shituf, when we were using things like a lechi or a korah, the idea was essentially to symbolically create some type of partition, right? But that was sort of the tension around that issue. Was it actually a real partition, or is it a symbolic partition by which you sort of mark the space, right? But here it seems that the food, there can't be anything symbolic about the food. There has to be a real, giving over of the food itself. So I thought this was a very, very interesting issue that got brought here. Anne, anything you want to add here before I jump down to something a little bit later on?
Well, I just want to comment on this idea of, you know, this distinction that you've made, right, about the lechi, the symbolic setup of an Eruv versus this, you know, what I keep thinking in my head is that it's very real world, that we have to have food that is usable and accessible at a, you know, not something that's beyond the regular participant here. I think that it is notable because I think, at least I'm interpreting here, right, that the reason you need the real food there as opposed to the symbolic sign of things is that this is where you see the cooperative living, right? It's not symbolic, like they really are sharing that space. So the idea of having something tangible, and it, I mean, the fact that it has to be tangible as opposed to symbolic makes sense to me. I don't know if this is really why, right? But it makes sense to me that there would be a need for it to be symbolic. I'm sorry, for it to be not symbolic, for it to be tangible, because you have a number of different households, a number of different people, and they all need to relate to this cooperative effort as legitimate, right? And the moment you get to symbolic, then I feel like someone's like, well, it doesn't really look like, you know, I understand that there's all these halachic determinations over whether the symbolism works in terms of, you know, how large, how long is a lechi and so on. But I don't know.
With you. I think there's something about the food that it can't just be symbolic. It actually needs to be real, where it's demarcating space in a symbolic way. You know, maybe it doesn't have to be as real because you see there's a visual there. It's very, very clear. You marked it. It just may not be a regular partition or a regular full marker, but the marker is still there, right? Whereas with food, right, you know, with this type of cooperative, everyone needs to have an actual full participation in it.
Although I would just note also, like, you know, to argue on myself, even the food, right, is within its, even with its tangibility, it has a measure of being symbolic in that it's not everybody sitting down to a shared meal, right? They might all have to have access and they might all have to have the ability to eat it or whatever, but it's not quite the same thing as equal participation in, right? It's not a cooperative meal. It's a cooperative effort to have the designated area.
Yeah, I absolutely hear that. But I think there is some, but I think we both agree there is some distinction being made here.
I think
so. Now I just want to move on to two more stories that are the similar setup about a baby whose warm water spills. These involved Rava, right? Reish Bet Aleph, not Rabba, who was the Amora before that we discussed. I actually had to read it a couple times to make sure that I got it straight, because I myself got a little bit confused. And the first story reads as follows: Hahu Yanuka di Ishbachuch Amime. Right. So again, we had this baby whose warm water spilled. Amar Luhu Rava. So Rava said to, I guess, people who asked of him, how could they get water to this baby? Nishaleli ime itzriche. Nachim lekoi agav ime. Right. So let's see if the mother needs warm water. Remember, we learned this in Masachat Shabbat, right? That if, you know, a mother needed it, right, till the time of the breed, right? Not it's, if I'm remembering correctly, within the first 3 days, it's sort of automatic that you could heat water for her. But between day 3 and 8, right, she just had to, if she says she needs it, you could, you know, a non-Jew could heat it for her. And so therefore we could say that the non-Jew's heating water, it's for the mother, but we can use it, for the baby. Because again, this period of time after delivery, you know, we really want to tend to the mother's needs. So this is amazing. Amar le Rav Misharshie le Rava. So Rav Misharshie says the following to Rava. Imeka achle tamre. He says his mother is going around and she's eating dates. In other words, this is not a person who's really ill, right? She seems to be very healthy. She's eating. I don't know what it is specifically about dates, why he says that, if that was, you know, a specific type of food that indicated more health. Amar le emor tenuba ba'amahu denakele. So Rava says to him, no, it could be that she had this ravenous hunger that seized her, that maybe because she actually was ill, right? We know that sometimes when you're ill, you do things that you're not really aware of that you're doing. And maybe she wasn't even aware that she was eating, and therefore she still was actually ill. So the point here is that Rava, what he was saying was, first of all, I think he was sort of trying to really give a solution, right? Which was sort of to say, in a way, like, you know, see if this mother could use something, right? How could it possibly be that she would not need something, you know, in this period of time so close to the birth? And also he's sort of saying a little bit like, you shouldn't assume anything just because, and I think this is a great approach to Psak Halacha, right? That you really need to talk to the person who the Psak Halacha is for, right? Don't just make an assumption that because you saw her do something, but you hadn't actually interacted with her, that you can make an assumption about her actual state of being. So I think this gives us some nice insight into how halacha is decided or is used. And then we have the last.
I gotta say, I feel like you would think everybody would learn from Eli and Chana in the Navi, right? In the book of Samuel, when Chana is praying and her lips are moving and no sound comes out, right? And
right.
She's praying and Eli says she's drunk. And you would think that they would just like go and talk to the person before you infer from their physical appearance what they seem to be doing. But no, we don't.
No. Well, I think this tells us something about humans altogether.
That's my point. That's exactly my point. Right. Like, we should be learning and not, you know, and not drawing conclusions without investigating. But,
right. But I
but
think
we
this
do.
Is how most people, you know, most, unfortunately, this is a very human trait. Okay, so then we have the third case again. Hahu Yanuka de Ish Bechuf Chamime. Right, again, this water spills of this baby. Amar Luhu Rava. Again, it's with Rava. So now he says, "Panu li mane mi be gavrei leve nafshe vaazil veitev hatam vaftle veevatel luhu hachatzer." So what does he say? He says, "Clear all my," and again, it's clear that he had not joined an Erev, which is amazing. "Clear away my belongings from the men's chamber," which apparently went out into the chatzer, "and put it in the woman's chamber," right? Which in those times, and I don't think this would come to a shock to anybody, was a more of an inner chamber, right? And so his concern was that maybe he would end up carrying his belongings into the courtyard, right? Which would then, you know, once he carries it out there, it showed that he didn't sort of renounce his rights anymore, right? And that's the discussion that they're going to proceed to get into, right? That if, let's say, somebody is, you know, mevatel his rights to a chatzer, but then he goes ahead and carries, right? In a way, does that mean that he undid, right, being mevatel the chatzer, whether or not it was on purpose, whether it was, you know, it was b'shogeg or whether it was b'mezid, right? That's what part of the discussion is here. But that's his solution. And then he says, fine. And then I'll go, I'll sit in the woman's chamber. And then I'll basically say that I have no rights to the courtyard. Right. And so therefore, and this has to do with the residents of the baby's courtyard. So they would be able to transfer water from, you know, from warm water from one courtyard to the other, because I basically, I renounced my rights there. Now, again, I'm not going to continue reading here. Ravina then gets into his discussion with Rava, which is, did he really have to do this? Does this follow the opinion of Shmuel? But my understanding from the story is that I actually think it's that Rava normally did not participate in Eruv. And I think what he was trying to do here was essentially to renounce his rights so that the other residents could actually establish an Eruv.
Okay, that's interesting. Sure. I think I see how you can read that.
That's how I sort of read into this. I thought it was an interesting story, but I think the larger picture to me here of what I want to draw on these particular stories here is, you know, looking at Rava and Abaye and Rava, that as much as we've been seeing, you know, all of this, you know, back and forth with the rabbis of how to establish Eruv correctly, here we have an example of like three Amoras who like did not bother to make an Eruv before Shabbat. And I'm actually just totally blown away by that.
I'm wondering, and I don't know that if we know the answer, meaning I clearly don't, but I don't know if the world knows. Right, the difference between the inner house, let's say, and the chatzer, and to what extent, like, I don't know, look, we both grew up in a town that didn't have an Eruv, and we managed fine for all those years. So I'm wondering, like, did they not make an Eruv because they weren't thinking about what needs they might have had because they didn't have those needs because whatever they were doing in the house was sufficient?
Yeah, right. And you're saying that, in other words, like they almost didn't need it.
Or they didn't realize that they needed it. Or, you know, given what they did on Shabbos, they didn't need it. And maybe their wives might have needed it, but they didn't, you know. I don't mean to
right,
be.
Right, I hear that. Know, but what's interesting is there seems to be with this last particular story, right, that like it's he almost has to give up his right so that other people can have access to the Eruv. But yes, there must have been a reason why none of them did it. And I think what you're explaining may not be a bad explanation for that.
Well, thank you. Okay, I'm going to jump towards the bottom of Amud Bet, where we have a story. We have really the Gemara is now going to be talking about the Mishnah that we talked about. We've already discussed, you know, days ago, on where it talks about Rabban Gamliel, maybe even more than days ago. Amar Rabban Gamliel. This is a quote really from the Mishnah. Maseh b'tzeduki achad shayad dar imanu. Right, the Rabban Gamliel, his family had a tzeduki who lived there in the same courtyard or the same alleyway, right, in Jerusalem, right? This is a story. And that same tzeduki would renounce his rights before Shabbat. So then the Mishnah comes and talks about, you know, are they allowed to use that alleyway? And the whole point is, right, that this was the discussion of whether, you know, in dealing with a tzeduki, they've got a different setup, right? It's not the same thing as if everybody's Jewish, even though a tzeduki is halachically considered Jewish, but it's not the same thing. And it's also not the same thing as the non-Jew case, because there it's very obvious that you have a non-Jew. What's the situation here with a tzeduki? And this is exactly where the Gemara tackles the Mishnah, because it says tzeduki mai dekar shmei. Right? Where do we get, what are you doing talking about a tzeduki all of a sudden? These are the Sadducees, right? But the key thing that we need to remember is that the Sadducees were the same people, in a sectarian society, they were the sect that did not accept rabbinic law, right? They didn't accept rabbinic interpretation. So when you're talking about an Erev, and as we've discussed, you know, this is a rabbinic construct and rabbinic limitations and so on. So then the tzeduki is not buying into the Erev. So then when you have a tzeduki who's living on the same alleyway as you, you know, then when it comes to Shabbat, that tzeduki, apparently, in Rabban Gamliel's story, right, meaning in his life, he would renounce his rights to be carrying in that same alleyway. So then that family did not need the tzeduki, so to speak, to make their Eruv. Okay, so, but the Gemara says, why are we suddenly talking about a tzeduki when up until this point, the Gemara has been talking about non-Jews? So this is a really interesting thing that happens, and I think we've discussed it before, but it's not common. The Gemara says, chesure mechzara, What does it mean? The Mishnah is incomplete, meaning the text itself is missing something. Now, this is a very strong radical sentence, you know, a radical statement to make. And the Gemara is allowed to make it again about the Mishnah. But if we came along and said that about the Mishnah, then we'd be kind of, you know, thrown out of the camp, so to speak. Meaning not literally, but the idea that we are going to emend the text of the Mishnah would be shocking, right? We don't do that, except for the Gemara does. Not often. And more often, I would say, to add something in, which is what's happening here. The idea is that the Mishnah is incomplete. What should it have said? What is the real text of the Mishnah? Meaning that statement that the Tzedukei is like the non should have been in the Mishnah to begin with. Rabban Gamliel Omer Tzedukei eno kagoy, which is the statement that then, and then Rabban Gamliel's statement is that no, the Tzedukei is not like a non-Jew. Amar Rabban Gamliel Maaseh Tzedukei Achad Shayad Darimanu B'Mavo Yerushalayim. And so then the whole case of the Tzedukei, his appearance there in the story of Rabban Gamliel, is to, you know, to illustrate or to attest to Rabban Gamliel's point that a Tzedukei is not like a non-Jew. In what way is not like a non-Jew? Because they specifically were involved with him, right? Va'amar lano Abba, his father, and you'll recall this, we talked about this before, his father, Rabban Gamliel's father, said to them, Maharu v'otziu et hakelim l'mavoy ad shelo yotzi v'yasur aleichem. Meaning, take everything out to the alleyway so that we establish our possession of the alleyway, right? Lest this Tzedukei bring all of his stuff out and he would then claim the alleyway. In which case, if he's staking his claim to his rights to take dominion over that mavoy, then the implication is that the family of Rabban Gamliel would not have been able to carry, because he, this same person who does not accept the concept of Eruv, is nonetheless exerting his ownership there, which means that he cannot participate in Eruv, but you can't nullify his presence either because he staked his claim. So it gets a little bit, you know, involved, but the idea is, there's, I think, several ideas that come out, one of which is that a Tzedukei is not like an non-Jew. And Rabban Gamliel's story and his rationale for his proof, I guess, really, that a Tzedukei is not like a non-Jew is a story from his life, right? That he was treated in this way as, you know, an in-between status between somebody who is not so far removed from Eruv that like a non-Jew, and you can just kind of end up nullifying that person's rights. But rather, there's a concern here, because he is Jewish, that you have to really get there first, so to speak. And then we have, again, another braita that attests to this, and then with this we'll close. Va'atanya, don't we have another braita that says, Hadar imanachri tzedukei ubaitusi hare elu osrin alav. Don't we have a braita? We did read this, or we read a version of this, right? That somebody who lives with a non-Jew, or a tzedukei, a Sadducee, or a baitusi, I don't think I can pronounce this in English.
So we explain what that is? We might need to do a little who's who about it.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So the Baitusis come from, if you read the first parak of Perkei Avot, right? So the first Mishnah Aleph, Perak Aleph, goes through the Mesorah, right? Moshe Kibel Umasra Li Yoshua, Yoshua Li Zakenim, until Anshe Knesset Agdola. The second Mishnah is Shimon Hatzadik, who's Misharei Anshe Knesset Hagdola. And then the third Mishnah mentions his student, who is Antigonus Ish Socho. And so Antigonus Ish Socho is a very, very interesting sort of, I guess I call those like pre-Tanas, right? Because he's actually not mentioned anywhere else. And basically, and he's the one who says that you should, you know, be like a servant, who doesn't, you know, who basically does what he needs to do for his master, not needing to get any reward. He basically had two students who, sort of misinterpreted that statement and said that, you know, that there basically was no Olam Haba. So sort of like, what's the purpose of any of this? One of those sects that developed from that were the Baitusim.
Okay. So, but what's important for our purposes here is that the Baitusim were also not really non-Jews, right? They were non-believers in rabbinic Judaism. which is not quite the same thing, as we all know, as saying that that's, that person's not Jewish. So let's come back to this Braita, right, where it says, Adarim and Achri Tzaduki Baitusi, one who lives with a non-Jew or a Tzaduki or a Baitusi, Hare Elo Osrin Alav. So any one of those three people, it, since they're not part of the cooperative and can't be part of the cooperative, they would end up rendering the Eruv, ostensibly, you know, the desirable Eruv, it makes it impossible, and it prohibits the Jews who live there from making an Eruv. And then in parentheses, the Gemara here says, Rabban Gamliel Omer, Tzaduki Baitusi, Eino Osrin. So Rabban Gamliel, again, he takes this position the same way that the Tzaduki is not considered like a non-Jew. A Baitusi also is not considered like a non-Jew, in which case, Einan Osrin, they don't end up prohibiting the carrying, right? Their presence does not nullify or render impossible the Eruv right. itself. And then, you know, this Braita continues to our, basically to our text. Again, the same details, right? The Tzaduki lives with them in the same alleyway in Jerusalem. Now, instead of it being Rabban Gamliel's father saying to Rabban Gamliel, here he's saying it to his children. This is a more dramatic reading, let's say. I'll explain in a moment. So Rabban Gamliel says to his sons, or his children, my children, quickly go and take out what you want to take out to the alleyway, and bring in what you need to bring in, so that you can do it before this Tzaduki does so. But here the word is to'ev, and that's from the word to'eva. A to'eva is generally considered an abomination. The translation I've seen here says a loathsome person, meaning despicable, meaning for whatever reason, he's very harsh in his characterization of this Tzaduki, the same Tzaduki that he said is not to be considered like a non-Jew, but in this case, this Braita puts it in a very negative light. I wonder what Rabban Gamliel's language actually was, and to what extent revision of, you know, finessing the text of the Talmud put in the word to'ev here. I wonder, I have a little book somewhere, I have to find it, called Chasronot HaShas. There's a book that was put out, I don't know, it's a Rishon, I think, about the censoring and emendations and things like that that were done on the text of the Shas as we know it. And I'm curious whether, you know, characterizing a Tzaduki as a to'ev, as a person who is loathsome or an abomination, was a rabbinic characterization.
Yeah, I would say there's two things here. So just to go back a little bit about the Baitusim and Tzadukim, you know, these were the two sects that sort of came out of Antigonus Yisocho's teaching. There's an Avot to Rabbi Natan, I was trying to find the source, but I can't find it, that describes this whole story. And the Baitusim themselves, they sort of lived these sort of rich and extravagant lives. You know, they were very into materialism because, again, the idea was this is all you had. There's not going to be any, there's no world to come. The Tzedukim are obviously sort of the more famous sect of these two sects, but they're very closely related. But I think we learned something very important here, that as much as, you know, these two sects really sort of were always at odds with the Perushim, with the rabbis, right? With rabbinic Judaism, Gamliel was not willing to go as far as to say that they are considered to be like the non-Jew. And I think that's really sort of the moral lesson that's very apparent here on this page in terms of his relationship with them. Yes, they're different, but when it comes to Eruv, we're not going to say that, you know, they're so far out of the bounds, we put them in the category of the non-Jew.
Right. Okay, fair enough. Also, we should note that they live close, right? Meaning they may have these real ideological, philosophical debates, disagreements, and it's real, meaning there's real implications from it. On the other hand, they live on the same block.
Right?
And
the same block.
And they have dealings
with
each other.
There.
They share the chutz there, exactly. And not only that, they have to navigate around each other. And if they were on, like, again, I gotta wonder, you know, were they on speaking terms? Like, what does it mean that they're running out to, you know, go out and make sure that you've you know, brought out the things you need to bring out and bring in the things you need to bring in quickly, quickly before the other guy gets there first, which is a strange, you know, competitive race to the Erev, to make sure your Erev is in place before
Right.
Shabbat. Okay, so this Braita then concludes, Ve'aser alechem, sherei bitel rushuto. So this is exactly that point, but here, this is Divrei Rebbe Meir. That's the version of the story in the Braita. That's Rebbe Meir's account of it. And then our daf almost concludes, but we're going to conclude here. Rabbi Yehuda, right? So Rabbi Yehuda is going to have a different version than Rabbi Meir, as he is wont. As is his wont. Rabbi Yehuda Omer b'lashon acheret. He says it was a different language, a different version of the story. Rabbi Gamliel said to them, "What did he say? Maharu v'asu tzorcheichem b'mavoi ad shelo techshach v'yasar alechem." He says, do what Rabbi Yehuda says, that Rabbi Gamliel said, rush, you know, go hurry and do whatever you need to do in that alleyway before Shabbat, because otherwise he's going to prohibit you from using the alleyway. Meaning the implications of Rabbi Yehuda's position is that no matter what they do, that prohibition is going to kick in, as opposed to Rabbi Meir's version, which seems to say that if they stake their claim, then his presence won't actually nullify their ability to carry in the courtyard.
All right, we're going to stop with that. It was a very long, lot to discuss on today's DAP. That's our DAP discussion for the day. Rank us, review us on all major podcasts. Thank you to Rabbi Michelle Farber for hosting us on the Hadron website. Let us know what you thought about some of the issues raised on this DAP on our Talking Talmud Facebook page. And until tomorrow.